Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and see such a large audience. Hope you're still here at the end. I'm going to tell you about experimental work, in the lab of my colleagues, Rob Sholkoff and Michelle Devoret. Most of the stuff I'll tell you about today is from Rob Sholkoff's lab. And the research project involves trying to build artificial atoms, make electrical circuits behave like artificial atoms. And the nominal purpose, or at least the source of the money, is quantum computation. But the physics I'm going to tell you about today is really trying to bring the notion of notions of quantum optics to electrical circuits, and be able to observe photons, for example, within electrical circuits. And so there's a big gang of people, a couple of Canadians here that we've been having fun working with. And so I'm going to tell you about a kind of quantum optics experiment called cavity QED, in which and one or more atoms interact with one or more photons inside a resonant cavity. And since it's taking place not in an optical cavity but in an electrical circuit, we call this circuit QED. So what we're trying to do is really kind of the moral equivalent of single spin nuclear magnetic resonance, which you cannot do with single nuclear spins because they have such tiny magnetic moments that you can't, neither you nor the environment can detect which way they're pointing, which is why they're so coherent for such a long time. We're going to build an electrical circuit, which is not a magnetic moment like a spin and a half, but nevertheless it's a quantum system with two distinct energy eigenstates. And any quantum system that has only two states in an Hilbert space can be thought of as a spin a half, and can be thought of as described by a spin vector that points somewhere on the Bloch sphere. And the experiments will consist of preparing superpositions of ground and excited state, which means tipping this fake spin through some arbitrary angle and then detecting its orientation. And rather than being with a real spin with its magnetic moment coupling to some coil, we're going to have some crazy electrical circuit that's analogous to this. So I'm going to talk about spins and qubits, but they're not real spins. It's just a fake spin that describes which of the two quantum states the electrical circuit is in. So there are a number of different... See, one of the qubits has disappeared. There it is. Okay. There are a number of different physical realizations of two-level quantum systems that people are pursuing for quantum computation. And even within the world of superconducting qubits, there are different designs that have various advantages and disadvantages. But the main thing I want to show you is that we're still at the very early stages. The first quantum coherence superposition of two states of such an electrical circuit was demonstrated in 1998 with a very short coherence time of order half a nanosecond or a nanosecond. In the just 4 years later, the coherence time was 1,000 times, 500 or 1,000 times longer. And people are now beginning to do experiments with two artificial atoms or two qubits, demonstrating some of the logic operations that are necessary for quantum computation. And Bell inequality tests of quantum mechanics are now being attempted. But the thing that all of these have in common is that they use classical electromagnetic fields, microwave fields. The transition energies of these atoms correspond to microwaves, gigahertz. And what we're trying to do that's a little bit different is to do physics that in which the quantized nature of the electromagnetic field is important. The fact that microwaves, despite their name, are actually particles. So we want to do not just artificial atomic physics, but we now want to do quantum optics. So cavity QED, we know that the effects on an electron or on an atom of the fact that the electromagnetic field is actually quantized, there are a number of such effects. For example, the simplest one is that if you prepare a hydrogen atom, put the electron in the 2p state, it will, when you first learn quantum mechanics, you find out that's a stable orbital, and the electron just stays up there. But then when you learn about quantization of the electromagnetic field, you find out that orbit is actually unstable. The electron can fall down and spontaneously emit a photon on a time scale of about a nanosecond. There are other, and these are effects of the zero-point fluctuations of the electromagnetic field in the vacuum. Another such effect, where you virtually emit and then reabsorb a photon, is that the electron mass changes, the Lamb shift, the 2s and 2p states shift their energy slightly by different amounts so that they're no longer degenerate as they are in the simplest theory of the hydrogen atom. Number of effects like that are very interesting to study in quantum electrodynamics. What cavity quantum electrodynamics does is instead of having a continuum of photon states available, which is why you get irreversible spontaneous decay, you discretize the spectrum. You put mirrors here or some sort of cavity which supports only discrete frequency modes. And let's say maybe even only one of them is near in frequency to the atom, so you can forget about all the other modes and just pay attention to one. And you can have interesting effects. If there's an atom in there which emits a photon, the photon is not going to run away to infinity. It's going to bounce off the mirror, come back, and hit the atom again, be reabsorbed, re-emitted, reabsorbed. And you can get coherent coupling between the excitation of the atom and the excitation of the vacuum, the electromagnetic field, and you can form kind of coherent bound states or funny hybrid molecules that are partly photon and partly atom excitation. So there are a couple of classic ways that quantum optics people do cavity QED. One is with microwaves at similar frequencies, a little bit higher than we'll be at 5 gigahertz. This Serge Roche experiment in Paris is at 50 gigahertz. They prepare a Rydberg atom in the N equals 50, L equals 50, 50th Bohr orbit, so it has a relatively large diameter, 2,500 Bohr radii. And the transition frequency between the 50th and the 51st state is 50 gigahertz. And they bring the atom into this cavity, which is has a resonance at that same frequency, 50 gigahertz. So if they prepare the atom in the 51st state, it can go into the cavity, resonantly fall down to the 50th state, emitting a photon, and then leaving the cavity. But if it stays in the cavity a long time, it might reabsorb that photon and then re-emit it and reabsorb it. And the probability that it ends up in the excited state oscillates with how long it's been inside the cavity. So this is the time the atom spent inside the cavity, and this is the probability that you find it in the excited state, and you see these so-called vacuum Rabi oscillations at a frequency of about 30 kilohertz, which is the rate at which the atom and the photon are exchanging energy. And you measure when the atom comes out, you can ionize it and to tell whether it was in the 50th or 51st state. And they have no way of actually directly seeing the photons. They see what happens to the atom after it comes out of the cavity. The other way you can do it is to look not at what happens to the atom, but what happens to the photons in the cavity. So here's a Caltech slide. You have this is done at optical frequencies with two highly reflecting mirrors. You make a Fabry-Perot cavity, which resonates at some particular wavelength of the laser. And then you drop many or a few or one atom through the cavity, and the atoms act like a little dielectric medium, which change the optical length because of their index of refraction. They change the optical length of the cavity and change whether it's on resonance or not and change the transmission probability for the laser beam passing through. And you use a photodetector to infer what's happening to the atoms by monitoring what's happening to the photons. Okay? So the experiments I'm going to tell you about monitor what's happening to the photons rather than the atoms directly. We're going to use the state of the photons to determine the state of the atoms. But it's going to be done at microwave frequencies in an electrical circuit. So it's somewhere in between these two experiments. Okay, so I'm a theorist, so I have to have one slide with a Hamiltonian on it. So here's the idea. You have a mirror. You have a laser or microwave beam coming in. You drop an atom through there. And there's really only one particular frequency mode of this cavity that we're interested in. There's only one that's nearby the atom. So let's ignore all the others. And that mode has frequency omega resonator. And it can have in that mode 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 photons, or 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 units of H bar omega of energy. So this is the number operator, A dagger A, that counts how many photons are inside. The atom has, well, many levels, but only two of them are of interest, the ground and first excited state. The others are, say, far away in energy. And so we can describe that as a quantum two-level system with the Pauli matrices, just like a spin-a-half electron, where spin-down might represent the ground state, spin-up might represent the excited state, and spin-sideways is a superposition of ground and excited states. Then there's a dipole coupling between the photons and the atom. So sigma plus is the operator that takes the spin from down to up. It takes the atom from the ground state to the excited state. And you eat up a photon in that process. Or vice versa, you create a photon and de-excite the atom. Then there are some other terms that have to do with damping. The mirrors don't have perfect reflectivity. Photons that are inside here can leak out at rate kappa. And the atom doesn't necessarily emit photons into this special cavity mode, especially in optical cavities, which are many wavelengths across. There's a lot of room to emit photons in other directions, and that leads to irreversible energy loss from the atom at rate gamma. So this is the quantum mechanics of open systems with dissipation, which complicates things but also makes it interesting. And it was a many decades search in the quantum optics community to reach what's called the strong coupling limit, where this G, this vacuum Rabi rate, where the rate at which the atom and photon are exchanging energy, is bigger than the rate at which the dissipation, kappa and gamma, the rate at which energy is leaving. If you're in the strong coupling limit, this G is big enough that the atom and photon field exchange energy many times before the energy is either lost this way or that way. Okay, that's called the strong coupling regime, and it was achieved about a decade ago, first at Caltech, I guess. So we want to try to get strong coupling. And so we want this vacuum Rabi frequency, G, to be as large as possible. And its value is given by a product of the transition dipole matrix element for the atom, which we want to be big, and the 0-point root mean square fluctuation of the electric field in the vacuum due to the fact that the electromagnetic field is quantized. And you can think of, you know, the mode as a harmonic oscillator, and the electric field is the coordinate, and the magnetic field is the conjugate momentum. And they're both uncertain in the quantum ground state of the vacuum. So the electric field inside the cavity is given by this number times A plus A dagger, where that destroys a photon and that creates a photon. So that's, if you've done the simple harmonic oscillator, you'll recognize that quantity as the coordinate of the oscillator. So remember this, we're going to use this at the end to measure the electric field of a single photon. Okay, so we want to build an electrical circuit analog for this cavity QD experiment, and instead of a laser beam, we're going to have an Agilent microwave generator. They're actually much less noisy than lasers and very much easier to work with. Probably even I could do it. I don't know, but maybe not. And instead of two mirrors, well, so then the photons are not going to be traveling in free space. They're going to be traveling down a transmission line. And we have a special kind of little waveguide or transmission line called a coplanar waveguide. So this, think of this surface here, and you've evaporated some superconducting metal. And these are the ground planes. And this is the center conductor. So it's very much like the coaxial cable going into your television, but it's two-dimensional. Okay? And it's superconducting, so there'll be no resistance and no losses. And the photon, the electric and magnetic fields of the photon, live in this little few micron gap between the center conductor and the ground plane. And it's interesting how small a space we can squeeze this photon into. We'll talk about that. The analog of these highly reflecting mirrors is you don't have to do anything complicated. Just put little breaks in the center pin. And this makes like organ pipe resonances, like acoustic resonances. But they're in this centimeter long thing. It resonates electromagnetically at 5 or 6 gigahertz. Okay, so that's going to be the cavity. The atom is going to be some other gadget that we'll talk about in a minute that's glued down right at an antinode of the electric field. So and it just sits there. We don't have the problem of finite transit time the way you have with real atoms. So here's an example of this cavity. Here's the niobium ground planes. There's the niobium center pin. And then, curiously, you can, instead of making it a straight line, you can make it wiggle back and forth. That way you can change the length of the resonator while keeping the location of the contact pins fixed. So if you want to change the frequency of the resonator, it's handy to have those meanders. There's the mirror, the little gap in the center pin there. Here's the transmission through the resonator. And you see it resonate. You reach good transmission at about some narrow point, 6 gigahertz. It has a Q. It's a harmonic oscillator. It has such low damping that the Q is about 600,000 or more. And the energy is, the frequency is 6 gigahertz. That corresponds to a quantum photon energy for the microwaves of about a third of a Kelvin. So this thing is sitting in a dilution refrigerator at 20 millikelvin. And so the oscillations of the electromagnetic field in this resonator have been cooled down to their quantum ground state. There are no photons inside. And despite the fact that there are wires running up down there from room temperature, there are tremendous filters, which are black bodies that absorb noise, and they're kept cold at the dilution refrigerator temperature, so they won't radiate because they are black bodies. And the inside, the electromagnetic temperature inside here is very close to 20 millikelvin. It's 100 times colder than the cosmic microwave background, and electromagnetically, it's essentially the coldest place in the universe. And those experimentalists will know that it's not so hard to keep cool the substrate. It's harder to cool the electrons, and it's really hard to cool the vacuum, the electromagnetic fields, to make them that cold. But that's what you have to do these experiments. So there's very low loss because these things are superconducting, and microwave photons can easily travel 10 kilometers while inside this kind of coplanar waveguide. Very much like optical fiber. We don't actually have a doer that's 10 kilometers long with helium in it. We have a thing that is the fact that it can bounce a million times between the centimeter-spaced mirrors is equivalent to 10 kilometers. So if somebody will give us the budget to make such a long thing, it should work. Okay, so that's the cavity. And those are the photons. Now we have to figure out about what is the atom. So I'm going to give you the spherical cow approximation to the atom first. So imagine that I have two pieces of superconductor, in this case aluminum. And they're very tiny, micron scale. And they're separated by a Josephson junction, a little aluminum oxide tunnel barrier. And in a superconductor, you don't have to know anything about superconductivity except that electrons like to travel around in spin singlet pairs. Okay? And there's a gap. There's an energy cost to break those pairs apart. And for the purposes of today's talk, that gap is just very, very big and we don't have to think about it. Okay? And suppose that the total number of electrons in this little system happen to be even, so everybody has a partner and they're paired up, but that the number of pairs happens to be odd, okay? 200 million plus one, say. So the two states of our quantum bit or our artificial atom are going to be that there's 100 million pairs here or 100 million plus one pairs here or the other way around. And amazingly, through the fact that those electrons are also waves, they're able to do cavity QED. One is with microwaves at similar frequencies, a little bit higher than, we'll be at 5 gigahertz. This Serge Roche experiment in Paris is at 50 gigahertz. They prepare a Rydberg atom in the N equals 50, L equals 50, 50th Bohr orbit, so it has a relatively large diameter, 2,500 Bohr radii. And the transition frequency between the 50th and the 51st state is 50 gigahertz. And they bring the atom into this cavity, which is has a resonance at that same frequency, 50 gigahertz. So if they prepare the atom in the 51st state, it can go into the cavity, fall down to the 50th state, emitting a photon, and then leaving the cavity. But if it stays in the cavity a long time, it might reabsorb that photon and then re-emit it and reabsorb it. And the probability that it ends up in the excited state oscillates with how long it's been inside the cavity. So this is the time the atom spent inside the cavity. And this is the probability that you find it in the excited state, and you see these so-called vacuum Rabi oscillations at a frequency of about 30 kilohertz, which is the rate at which the atom and the photon are exchanging energy. And you measure when the atom comes out, you can ionize it and to tell whether it was in the 50th or 51st state. And they have no way of actually directly seeing the photons. They see what happens to the atom after it comes out of the cavity. The other way you can do it is to look not at what happens to the atom, but what happens to the photons in the cavity. So here's a Caltech slide. You have this is done at optical frequencies with two highly reflecting mirrors. You make a Fabry-Perot cavity, which resonates at some particular wavelength of the laser. And then you drop many or a few or one atom through the cavity, and the atoms act like a little dielectric medium, which change the optical length of, because of their index of refraction, they change the optical length of the cavity and change whether it's on resonance or not and change the transmission probability for the laser beam passing through. And you use a photodetector to infer what's happening to the atoms by monitoring what's happening to the photons. Okay? So the experiments I'm going to tell you about monitor what's happening to the photons rather than the atoms directly. We're going to use the state of the photons to determine the state of the atoms. But it's going to be done at microwave frequencies in an electrical circuit. So it's somewhere in between these two experiments. Okay, so I'm a theorist, so I have to have one slide with a Hamiltonian on it. So here's the idea. You have a mirror. You have a laser or microwave beam coming in. You drop an atom through there. And there's really only one particular frequency mode of this cavity that we're interested in. There's only one that's nearby the atom. So let's ignore all the others. And that mode has frequency omega resonator. And it can have in that mode 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 photons, or 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 units of H bar omega of energy. So this is the number operator, A dagger A, that counts how many photons are inside. The atom has, well, many levels, but only two of them are of interest, the ground and first excited state. The others are, say, far away in energy. And so we can describe that as a quantum two-level system with the Pauli matrices, just like a spin a half electron, where spin down might represent the ground state, spin up might represent the excited state, and spin sideways is a superposition of ground and excited states. Then there's a dipole coupling between the photons and the atom. So sigma plus is the operator that takes the spin from down to up. It takes the atom from the ground state to the excited state. And you eat up a photon in that process. Or vice versa, you create a photon and de-excite the atom. Then there are some other terms that have to do with damping. The mirrors don't have perfect reflectivity. Photons that are inside here can leak out at rate kappa. And the atom doesn't necessarily emit photons into this special cavity mode, especially in optical cavities, which are many wavelengths across. There's a lot of room to emit photons in other directions, and that leads to irreversible energy loss from the atom at rate gamma. So this is the quantum mechanics of open systems with dissipation, which complicates things but also makes it interesting. And it was a many decades search in the quantum optics community to reach what's called the strong coupling limit, where this G, this vacuum Rabi rate, where the rate at which the atom and photon are exchanging energy, is bigger than the rate at which the dissipation, kappa and gamma, the rate at which energy is leaving. If you're in the strong coupling limit, this G is big enough that the atom and photon field exchange energy many times before the energy is either lost this way or that way. Okay, that's called the strong coupling regime, and it was achieved about a decade ago, first at Caltech, I guess. So we want to try to get strong coupling. And so we want this vacuum Rabi frequency G to be as large as possible. And its value is given by a product of the transition dipole matrix element for the atom, which we want to be big, and the 0-point root mean square fluctuation of the electric field in the vacuum due to the fact that the electromagnetic field is quantized. And you can think of the mode as a harmonic oscillator, and the electric field is the coordinate, and the magnetic field is the conjugate momentum. And they're both uncertain in the quantum ground state of the vacuum. So the electric field inside the cavity is given by this number times A plus A dagger, where that destroys a photon and that creates a photon. So that's, if you've done the simple harmonic oscillator, you'll recognize that quantity as the coordinate of the oscillator. So remember this, we're going to use this at the end to measure the electric field of a single photon. Okay, so we want to build an electrical circuit analog for this cavity QD experiment, and instead of a laser beam, we're going to have an Agilent microwave generator. They're actually much less noisy than lasers and very much easier to work with. Probably even I could do it, I don't know, but... maybe not. And instead of two mirrors, then the photons are not going to be traveling in free space. They're going to be traveling down a transmission line. And we have a special kind of little waveguide or transmission line called a coplanar waveguide. So think of this surface here, and you've evaporated some superconducting metal, and these are the ground planes. And this is the center conductor. So it's very much like the coaxial cable going into your television, but it's two-dimensional. Okay? And it's superconducting, so there'll be no resistance and no losses. And the photon, the electric and magnetic fields of the photon, live in this little few micron gap between the center conductor and the ground plane. And it's interesting... how small a space we can squeeze this photon into. We'll talk about that. The analog of these highly reflecting mirrors is you don't have to do anything complicated. Just put little breaks in the center pin. And this makes like organ pipe resonances, like acoustic resonances. But they're in this centimeter-long thing. It resonates electromagnetically at 5 or 6 gigahertz. Okay, so that's going to be the cavity. The atom is going to be some other gadget that we'll talk about in a minute that's glued down right at an antinode of the electric field. So and it just sits there. We don't have the problem of finite transit time the way you have with real atoms. So here's an example of this cavity. Here's the niobium ground planes. There's the niobium center pin. And then, curiously, you can, instead of making it a straight line, you can make it wiggle back and forth. That way you can change the length of the resonator while keeping the location of the contact pins fixed. So if you want to change the frequency of the resonator, it's handy to have those meanders. There's the mirror, the little gap in the center pin there. Here's the transmission through the resonator. And you see it resonate. You reach good transmission at about some narrow point, 6 gigahertz. It has a Q. It's a harmonic oscillator. It has such low damping that the Q is about 600,000 or more. And the energy is, the frequency is 6 gigahertz. That corresponds to a quantum photon energy for the microwaves of about a third of a Kelvin. So this thing is sitting in a dilution refrigerator at 20 millikelvin. And so the oscillations of the electromagnetic field in this resonator have been cooled down to their quantum ground state. There are no photons inside. And despite the fact that there are wires running up down there from room temperature, there are tremendous filters, which are black bodies that absorb noise, and they're kept cold at the dilution refrigerator temperature so they won't radiate because they are black bodies. And the inside, the electromagnetic temperature inside here is very close to 20 millikelvin. It's 100 times colder than the cosmic microwave background. And electromagnetically, it's essentially the coldest place in the universe. And those experimentalists will know that it's not so hard to keep cool the substrate. It's harder to cool the electrons. And it's really hard to cool the vacuum, the electromagnetic fields, to make them that cold. But that's what you have to do these experiments. So there's very low loss because these things are superconducting. And microwave photons can easily travel 10 kilometers while inside this kind of coplanar waveguide. It's very much like optical fiber. We don't actually have a Dewar that's 10 kilometers long with helium in it. We have a thing that is the fact that it can bounce a million times between the centimeter-spaced mirrors is equivalent to 10 kilometers. So if somebody will give us the budget to make such a long thing, it should work. Okay, so that's the cavity, and those are the photons. Now we have to figure out about what is the atom. So I'm going to give you the spherical Cal approximation to the atom first. So imagine that I have two pieces of superconductor, in this case aluminum, and they're very tiny, micron scale, and they're separated by a Josephson junction, a little aluminum oxide tunnel barrier. And in a superconductor, you don't have to know anything about superconductivity except that electrons like to travel around in spin singlet pairs. Okay? And there's a gap. There's an energy cost to break those pairs apart. And for the purposes of today's talk, that gap is just very, very big, and we don't have to think about it. Okay? And suppose that the total number of electrons in this little system happen to be even, so everybody has a partner and they're paired up, but that the number of pairs happens to be odd, okay? 200 million plus one, say. So the two states of our quantum bit or our artificial atom are going to be that there's 100 million pairs here or 100 million plus one pairs here or the other way around. And amazingly, through the fact that those electrons are also waves, they're able to rise time of the cavity. And then this is an average from many shots. You see it start falling at a rate given by the fact that the qubit, unfortunately, has a finite lifetime, although this is a record for these type of qubits, 7.7 microseconds. If you apply a pulse that drives the qubit coherently from ground to excited and back to ground very quickly, nothing happens. The measurement is sufficiently simple that we can fit to the measured signal and determine that the fidelity of rotation is close to 100%. The reason this doesn't go all the way up and stay here is just due to the finite lifetime of the qubit. So now you can do various atomic physics experiments, Rabi oscillations, where you drive the qubit around from ground to excited state through various superposition states and measure that you have done that successfully. You can do Ramsey interference experiments. And so what I'm going to, so qubit is working as an artificial atom. What I'm going to do now is tell you about experiments which tell us about the quantized nature of microwaves, the fact that they're made out of photons, and see effects, even though the energy of those photons is 10,000 times less than those of visible light. So there's a way of doing spectroscopy on the atom. Here's the line shape of the atom, the probability that it absorbs a photon of frequency omega. And the way that works is you just illuminate the qubit with a frequency at the transition frequency, and it starts to go into the excited state, and that changes the phase shift of the other photons at the cavity frequency passing through the cavity. And it's a relatively narrow line, a Q of 20,000. But whenever you're whenever you're continuously making this measurement of whether the qubit's in the ground state or the excited state using those cavity photons, there has to be some back action of that effect on, of that measurement on the thing you're measuring. When you measure X, you destroy your knowledge of the momentum and vice versa. So the thing that's conjugate to knowing whether you're in what sigma z is, the ground or excited state, is the phase of the superposition of up and down. So I showed you before that the coefficient of A dagger A, that which was the new cavity frequency, depended on the state of the qubit. Now I can just rearrange the parentheses in that expression and say, no, the interaction, that level repulsion, changed the coefficient of sigma z. That is, it changed the transition frequency for the atom by an amount that depends on the number of photons in the cavity. It's the very same term. I just moved the parentheses around. And that term is called the light shift, or the AC Stark shift. And it says that the energy needed to excite the qubit depends on how many photons are in the cavity. So here's the spectrum of the qubit when there's one photon, and here when there are 20. And you see that it has shifted up some distance, the AC Stark shift. But you've also seen that it gets lower and gets smeared out. And that's because this is not just a number. When you illuminate the cavity with some amplitude of microwaves, classically there would just be a certain amount of energy in the cavity. But quantum mechanically, there's a certain number of photons, and it fluctuates around by 20 plus, or, you know, around 20 by about plus or minus the square root of 20. It's Poisson distributed. And as a result, the actual size of the AC Stark shift is jumping around all the time, moving up and down, as individual discrete quanta of energy of photons go into and out of the cavity. And that smears out the transition frequency of the qubit, and that's the measurement-induced dephasing or measurement back action for this case. So that's what produced that broadening. So now you might ask, well, what would happen if I could make this second-order frequency shift, this light shift, per photon larger than the line width of the atom? Then I should be able to resolve those individual peaks and see how many photons there were in the cavity. So if I could make this coupling really, really strong, I'd be able to see that. Well, in order to make the coupling strong, all you have to do is build a bigger atom. So this atom is similar design before, but it's basically you've got a bigger antenna hooked to it to talk to the microwaves. It's 300 microns long, so even I can see it with my naked eye, squinting. And it's nevertheless, there's a little Josen junction there. Nevertheless, this thing visible to the naked eye can be in a superposition of the ground and excited states for a reasonably long length of time. So the new vacuum Rabi coupling is now 10 times bigger. And when you do the experiment with that, here's the spectrum of this object in the presence of drive on the cavity, and that's the transition frequency when there are zero photons, one photon, two, three, four, five, six. And you can resolve the individual peak. So the fact that the line got broader was already proof that microwaves are particles, but the fact that it gets broad enough that you see individual peaks should really convince you that microwaves are actually particles. One of the things that you can do is drive the cavity with a coherent state, just an ordinary, that's the analog of a laser, and you get this Poisson distribution of number of photons in the cavity. The area under these peaks is approximately the probability that you had n photons or one, and there, in this particular experiment, there are some nonlinear effects that make that only approximately true. And you can see what looks like a qualitatively, at least, a Poisson distribution. Or you could use a thermal state, a black body state, which we didn't do by heating up some resistor to a couple of Kelvin, but just digitally synthesized by putting random noise on the microwave source. And then you see a monotone decreasing Bose-Einstein distribution. So you can use this effect as a photon statistics analyzer. If you made a squeezed state of the photon field, say a Fock state that had exactly one photon in it and no other possible values, you would be able to see that with this detector. Okay, so I'm going to finish up now with most recent measurements, asking the question, what is the electric field of a single photon? Is there a way to make single photons? Well, one way you might think would be able to take a laser or other coherent source and just put a absorber there that absorbs most of the photons so that you get very few photons. Every once in a while, one comes out. Well, that works in the sense that there are very few photons coming out, but they're still Poisson distributed. You don't know where they are. They're just coming out at random. And sometimes you have zero, sometimes you have one, sometimes you have two. It's still a kind of classical, relatively close to a classical kind of electromagnetic field. So we're going to use something called the Purcell effect to be able to generate a single microwave photon on demand. So here is, as a function of this control parameter, the B field that puts flux through that little squid loop, here is the fixed transition frequency of the cavity, and here's the varying transition frequency of the qubit. And you can see they get coupled together and split by this vacuum Rabi splitting, this 200 megahertz. So we're going to keep the qubit well detuned away from the resonator, but we're going to bring it a little bit closer so that you can see its line width starting to get bigger and bigger. The line width of the cavity, kappa, is relatively large. We chose rather poorly reflecting mirror so that the photons tend to leak out of the cavity very fast. And so what that does when you bring the qubit a little bit closer to the cavity transition and they get mixed together in second order perturbation theory, when you excite the atom, there's actually a small probability that that excitation is actually a photon. And if it's a photon, it can leak out very fast from the cavity. So you can enhance the decay rate of your atom in such a way that with 80 or 90% probability, when it decays by emitting a photon into the cavity. And the cavity has a good reflecting mirror and a poorly reflecting mirror, so that photon always comes out the right-hand side. And what we're going to do is put a control pulse on the qubit and make a superposition of ground and excited state. Then we're going to wait. Nothing's going to happen to the ground state, but the excited state is going to decay, emitting a photon. And now we're going to have the very same superposition, complex numbers here, alpha and beta, but now the quantum information is stored in the superposition of zero and one photon instead of ground and excited state of the qubit. So we're going to map the quantum information from the fixed qubit to the flying qubit, which is the superposition of photons. And so you can try the following experiment. You could, say, send in a control pulse which exactly puts the qubit in its excited state. That will produce then exactly one photon, which will come out, be radiated out. And then you can ask, well, let's measure the electric field by interference experiment or a Homodyne detection. And when you have exactly one photon, remember the electric field is the coordinate of the harmonic oscillator. It's A plus A dagger. And this changes the number of photons. This destroys one, that creates one. So this has no matrix element in a state that has definitely one photon. So the average electric field from a single photon is zero. There's some electric field, but it's completely random in phase. On the other hand, if you were to make a control pulse on the qubit that put it in an equal superposition with a certain phase of ground and excited states, then the electromagnetic field a short time later would be in an equal superposition of zero and one photons. And then when you measure the electric field, you get something. In fact, the phase of the electric field that you get tells you the phase of the superposition of ground and excited states of the atom. So here is, as a function of, you apply a control pulse to the atom, which just rotates it around the Bloch sphere some number of times. That's plotted here, from ground to excited to ground to excited. And the blue curve is the measured probability that the qubit is in the excited state. So you see the Rabi oscillations like this. And the red curve is a diode measurement, listening to the power of microwaves coming out. And you see that they're perfectly matched together. You have a higher probability of getting electromagnetic power when the qubit is in the excited state. Down here, the blue curve is a measure of the super sigma x, the superposition of ground and excited states. And the red curve is one of the quadratures of the electric field. And you can see that they also match very well. But you can see that this curve is shifted by 90 degrees from that curve, because when you have a pi rotation, so you definitely have excited the qubit, you definitely end up with one photon, and that has zero electric field. But if you only rotate the qubit partway, so you might or might not have excited it, then you have the highest electric field amplitude. So, quantum mechanics works. So now you can do something called fluorescence tomography. You can prepare the qubit in some superposition and then look at the phase of the electric field that's coming out. So these funny curves are this direction. So a point here represents you rotated the qubit a certain amount around the x-axis and a certain amount around the y-axis. So it just tells you the phase of the superposition you generated. And the grayscale is the measure of the probability the qubit ended in the excited state. These curves over here are the cosine and sine quadratures of the electric field in those same cases. And my experimental colleagues wanted me to make sure I pointed out this is data and not simulations. So. And it exactly fits what's expected. So with some probability that we're still calibrating, but of order 50% or more, we're generating single microwave photons on demand or coherent superpositions of zero and one microwave with any desired phase that you want. So for the future, there are experiments going on now with, or just starting now, putting two qubits inside one cavity and using the cavity photon mode as a kind of bus to communicate back and forth between them to start doing two-qubit logic gates for quantum computation. It might be possible to, now that we know how to transfer information, quantum information, from the qubit to the cavity, if we made a very high Q cavity, we could use that as a quantum memory that would store the superposition of zero and one photons for a longer time than our somewhat embarrassing atoms are able to store these superpositions. So that would be nice. It might be able to put one atom in two cavities, have the quantum memory here as a high Q cavity and a low Q cavity for reading out the state of the atom. And then Rob Sholkoff and Dave DeMille and Peter Zoller and John Doyle and various people are working on a proposal to put ensembles of atoms or individual atoms or diatomic molecules near this kind of structure to take advantage of this thousandfold increase in the zero-point electric field near such structures and take advantage of the long coherence times that are available with such with real atoms, although when they get near our ugly surfaces, maybe they will also become embarrassing. It's hard to say at this point. So to summarize, we've started thinking about circuit quantum electrodynamics, cavity QED with electrical circuits. We started with a series of experiments that were sort of classic experiments from atomic physics, and now we've moved into some ultra-strong coupling regime that can't be achieved with real atoms, and used that to observe for the first time the particle nature of microwave photons in electrical circuits. Thank you. I don't know if there is a record for that, but if there is, this might hold it. I don't know.
Can you think of another large object like that in quantum?
No. So, not at the moment. Bose condensates are classical matter waves. They're not quantum. Immanuel Bloch was the first person to discover the underlying quanta of such matter waves called atoms. When he
I'm saying it is a large object that can be in an internal space or position. It's not as large as 300 microns.
Right. And you can't actually see them with your eye. Yeah. But then they're not coherent anymore. Yeah.
Yep. I'd like you to clarify one point. Yeah. That's one point that you can have one photon, but you cannot measure the electric field of this photon.
Well, you can measure it, and each time you do, it's random, and on average, it's zero.
So the photon has an electric field. It's just
even the vacuum, even no photons, has an electric field, right? And the root mean square value is quarter volt per meter. But its average value is zero. Just as the average position of a harmonic oscillator is zero, but the wave function is spread out over some distance.
When you do this photon number measurement and you get this nice statistical distribution, what are the prospects for doing that measurement quickly enough that you could remeasure the same system and really see if you come out?
Right. So I didn't emphasize that these are QND measurements, that coupling term commutes with both A dagger A and sigma Z. So you can measure both the atom and the cavity in a QND way. So what the way we'd like to do it is with a setup like this, where you have one fast cavity for quickly determining the state of the qubit, and then one long-lived cavity where you could measure how many photons are in there and see the quantum jumps of the number of photons in there as they change with time. Once again, trying to follow in Serge Roche's footsteps. So this is something that we're trying to design now, and in principle will work, but we haven't done it yet. Yeah.
Are there other groups doing these experiments?
Other groups... Yeah. So other groups have done some things with lumped element resonators or sort of complete frequency mismatch between the resonator and the atom. This is a somewhat different regime. But a lot of people have noticed that this seems to be working well, and we're hoping that other people will begin to take it up. Yeah.
Is there anything that explains with those individual beats?
Yes, that's a good question. So the width of these individual peaks is determined by a number of things. First, the atom itself has some natural width because it can just decay and emit its energy into dirt or something. We don't know exactly what it is. There's a certain width from that. Then the length of time that the cavity let's say the cavity has one photon in it right now, and you make the experiment and you see that. But the length of time it had exactly one photon is finite because photons are always jumping in and coming out. And in fact, the more photons that you have, like the sixth level, they're jumping in and out six times faster. So that ends up gradually broadening these lines. In fact, in this particular experiment, it turns out there's some dirt effects, some charge noise effects, which tend to smear out these higher lines more than just this effect that I described. If you look at the numbers, we should be able to resolve about 70 peaks, and it's just due to this charge noise that we have a problem. But we understand where it is, and we hope we understand how to fix it. So there is we think we have a semi-quantitative understanding of that width, although, and you can see at least for weak driving, these are master equation simulations of the dynamics of this driven damped system, and it fits nicely to the data. But once you get up here, the Hilbert space is getting so big we haven't figured out a way to simulate it yet. But I think we have some understanding of where that comes from. So we've looked at using these types of cavities to do parametric down conversion, theoretically. So the cavities are nice. They're only one wavelength long, so the next mode is at twice the frequency. So you can resonantly send in 2 omega photons and hope to get out 2 1 omega photons, which are also resonant with the cavity. And you don't have the kind of problems you have in nonlinear optical materials with mode phase matching and things, because there's only one atom and there's no momentum conservation. And the numbers look actually pretty good, that you should even be able to drive it above threshold and get coherent production. But the experiment hasn't been done yet. I'm pushing on my colleagues to try it. But.